downtown, underground, CKUW 95.9 in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada.
Following is an encore presentation from CKUW's archives. Join us next week when the regular host will be back with a new episode of original programming.
So hurry down the chimney tonight. Come on and hurry down the chimney tonight. How long will I love you? As long as stars are above you. Longer if I can. How long will I need you? As long as the seasons need to follow their plan. How long will I be with you? As long as the sea is bound to wash upon the sand.
Good morning, folks, and if you're hearing that song by Al Golding, How Long Will I Love You, it's you're listening to the Hope Alley of No Fixed Address show, and I chose that song about a year ago. I think we changed over maybe 2 years ago because it shows a commitment, and it's a song about commitment, and about the commitment we have to work with the vulnerable who are on our streets. And I welcome you to the show today. It's starting to feel like winter. I think the last 2 days we're getting the realization that winter is finally here. And but we've been lucky going all the way to December 1st without feeling the effects of winter. But, you know, it's especially hard on folks who are on the street today. And as I always say, be kind when you're at Tim's, you're at Robin's, or at Starbucks. Buy a second coffee, buy a steep tea, buy something for somebody that's going to be sitting right outside the door in Portage Avenue, because they need it probably more than you do. And, you know, I like to carry around a bottle of water with me all the time so I can give somebody something. And in wintertime, you know, it's always good to buy the extra cup of coffee for someone. We are looking at the weather today. It's minus 11. And it's not that bad, but if you got to be out there 24/7, nothing's good. Again, you're listening to Al on the Hope Alley of No Fixed Address show. And today I have a person I just met for the first time about 2 weeks ago. Chantal, are you there?
Hello.
Yes. Hey, good to have you on the air. I usually have to wait months to get somebody on the air, so it's nice.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm so glad that you came to our lived experience of kind of State of the Union yeah, in a moderate way, a little small little mini forum that we had. And I was really impressed with the way you articulated things, and I'm so thrilled that that you're in the position you are at 190 Disraeli. What I do with everybody is in whatever you care to share about your history and how you got to this place, you know, and we'll get into the, you know, nuts and bolts shortly, but just share what you wish to speak about your lived experience, and because I think it's so important that people hear stories of lived experience, and I get people with lived experience on as much as I can, but some folks just don't, are still not ready to speak about their experiences, and but it's so important that people hear that people who have experienced homelessness can raise their lives to new heights and levels. And I'm so thrilled that, you know, you have the position of office manager over at 190, or did in the way, Mac. But please, if you would.
Okay, so my lived experience is quite a range. Mm-hmm. I guess to start off, I got into a car accident many, many years ago.
Okay.
Got addicted to opiates, like prescribed opiates,
mm-hmm.
The pharmaceutical, ended up cutting me off of that. I ended up like going into heavier drugs to fill that.
Mm-hmm.
After that, my good life kind of took like a really big spiral. My kids were taken from me. I became homeless.
Wow.
You know, and like, you know, and I had a, you know, I had already gone through a lot of stuff at that point, but you know, being exposed to being homeless,
mm-hmm.
you know, I ended up being sexually exploited,
mm-hmm.
Trafficked to Thunder Bay. I just, you know, it was years of this and living, you know, couch to couch, mm-hmm. or not knowing where I was going to stay. And very scary life, very scary time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I've been, you know, 3 years sober now.
Well, congrats, yeah.
Yeah, my life has changed dramatically, in a very good way. You know, now everything I've been through, I'm able to give back to my community, mm-hmm. in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
With that life experience and knowledge of knowing, instead mm-hmm. of just, you know, assuming that I know.
Entirely, which is far too often the case of people who assume. And this is where our value comes in, right? And this is why I stand so strong on the power of lived experience. And yes, we know, we've been there. We don't just think about it, right? Yeah.
And that's the thing, right? It's coming from a place of knowing. And I think that you're able to connect with, you know, the relatives that we do work with. We're able mm-hmm. to come from a place of understanding, and
yes.
I think that it's much more meaningful that way, and it's taken better that way.
It is, and you know, and again, the reason why I called for the forum, and you know, thank goodness the Main Street Reaction Project came up with the money for us to actually get paid and have a meal and that kind of thing. But it's because of the disrespect that, you know, people who should know better, but don't behave that way, and the way, you know, we have been treated by other people, leaders in the community, who it's taken a long time to come to the terms with the value that we bring. And thank goodness Frank is one of those people who understands that. Yeah, your boss, and he's been on my show as well. And but it's taken so many years for people to actually understand what we're talking about, or that we actually know maybe more than their you know, master's degrees in sociology or something, right?
Well, recognizing that too, right? Just being recognized, instead of, you know, okay, this person's gone through this, well,
mm-hmm.
you know, they know nothing. Like, that's not very, like, once you've lived through something, then all the gifts that you're given after you
mm-hmm.
you've survived that,
yes,
is not something that anybody can take away.
No, they can't. And you know, people always caution me about overwork and taking care of myself and all that kind of thing, and that's my Achilles heel, I guess. But you know, that lived experience is, for me, it's been, and for everybody, I'm sure, or for me anyway, it's a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing because we have the wisdom, right? And for those of us that can share that wisdom, It's really, really good and can articulate it like you and I can. There's so many that can't. But it's also what drives me to overwork, and it's that fire that never goes out, and you want it to go away, but it doesn't, you know.
And it's also because you thrive in chaos, too. It's crazy to say that, but like when you live that life, it's like you thrive in it, right?
Yes.
You thrive in it.
You do. And you know, I also think that that surviving the chaos and working through that chaos and being in that chaos, it really helps, you know, me today in the advocacy work I do, because it's we're stronger for having to deal with all that stuff, right? I think
100%. Yeah, I mean, when you go through the storm, you come out
yes.
the storm with a lot of, you know, more patience, being humble, not egotistic.
No.
A lot of times, you know, we go through these journeys, and like when you go through those journeys, there's a reason for them, right?
There is. And you know, all things happen for a reason. I've come to believe that. I never used to, but I have to.
Right? And I've come to that too. You know what? I was stuck in it. I didn't. But now I'm like, hey, all of this happened to bring me where I am now, right?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I found myself, for me, you went through the trouble of addiction and all. I always say if I had an addiction on the street, I wouldn't be here today. I was not strong enough for that. And I laud people who are on the street and who have addictions and are still surviving, right? Because it's so tough. And I did not have that. I had mental illness issues after losing a $200,000 a year job and being unmedicated for acute depression at that time. And never getting help for it, and not being able to handle the trauma of losing a career position. And I chose the street to commit because I thought, you know, the winter of 2010 was really, really cold. We had wind chills of minus 40, 50, and occasionally 60. And my modus operandi was I had no purpose in my life after losing my job, and I was thinking about ways to kill myself. And I wasn't going to, you know, sit in the bathtub and cut my wrist because I hit the side of the bed and I wasn't going to hang myself in case something happened and I didn't kill myself, but became a paraplegic. And so I chose hypothermia. So one day I just walked away from my apartment and it was minus 39 that day with wind chill minus 46 or something. And I thought, okay, this is going to take 1 or 2 days. And like I was sleeping in the car on the corner of William and McPhillips in a piece of junk Mercedes that they use for parts. And there's like 13 cars in the back lane there, and I chose one of them. And I thought, okay, yeah, one night, maybe two nights, and I'll be gone, and that's great. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. I got frostbite everywhere. And through that winter, and I became really sick and everything, but I never succumbed to hypothermia. And so my... Yeah, and people don't realize that folks end up on the street for so many different reasons, and mine was not an addiction. I had somebody, again, this is that stigma that follows us around. And so I was talking to one person, and she says, oh, you know, I really applaud the work you do and all this kind of thing, but are you still addicted to something? You know, do you smoke? Are you a drinker? Like, what are you addicted to? I said, did I say I was addicted to something?
Who measures that? I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Who feels the need they can measure why somebody would go through that?
Entirely. So she assumed that I was on the street because I was addicted to something. It's like, holy smokes, lady, you got a lot to learn.
And I mean, somebody like that, for example, right? And this is just the reality of it is someone like that, like, you know, even though I have a job, I'm a few paychecks away from being homeless.
Of course.
Again, the cost of living is insane.
It is.
And, you know, it can happen to anybody.
In a heartbeat. In a heartbeat. And you know what? There are so many crises that come around. You know, and here's a prime example. I'm a caregiver to a person with schizophrenia and PTSD. And, you know, and it's not easy because this person always has issues, you know, and whether you're looking after, okay, mental health animal dying and having to deal with those issues, the vet bills, having to deal with, you know, dental and vision care and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes life gets so tough and you can end up in the street in a heartbeat unless, you know, you get some help along the way. I'm so glad that you're on the same page as this, but one thing I really, really dislike is assumptions and stigmatizing, right, and drawing judgments. And, You know, I never spoke to any of my family for 5 years. Now, my last name is Weeb, and my dad was a Mennonite pastor. And I grew up in that judgmental environment. And I did not want to speak to any of my family. And so after I lost my job, I ended up, you know, traveling the country and went and saw my brother in London. And I walked away from that because all he wanted me there was to fix his rec room, and I didn't want to do that. I walked away, and when I left my brother's place in London, I was out of work because I lost my job, but because I just lost my job like the week before, my career. But I simply didn't want the judgment of even losing my job. And then, of course, after I became homeless, even 2 years afterwards, I didn't want to speak to anybody. And I accidentally ran into my sister at a funeral, and I'm not sure how I got to the funeral in the first place, but I ran into my sister 2 years out of homelessness, and we, you know, finally got a relationship back together. But if it hadn't happened by accident, I'm not sure I would have initiated that, because you and I both know that there's stigma attached, you know, to homelessness.
100%, whether it's your family or not, right? And I think that a lot of, you know, even when I was going through sexual exploitation, it's always like a judgy thing. And it's like, well, okay, you can judge me all you want, but where are you? Where are you in helping me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as much as they could. I mean, my kids were with my parents and stuff. So it's like, you know, I had nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and then that judgment. And then now, right? And I'm confident in who I am now.
Mm-hmm.
But for a long time, I couldn't sit there and say, you know, this is, I didn't identify as what it was.
Yes.
I was like, no, I was a sex worker. Like, no, in actuality, you look at it in a deeper term, this is actually what was going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, and now I'm comfortable, but a lot of people are not, because there's a stigma around it, right?
Of course.
Like, oh, you did that. Oh, here's my judgment on you.
Yes.
And that's not right.
No, it certainly isn't. And this is one of the things that that you and I, as people who can speak to the matter, you know, we have to, right? And we have to be strong on our message. And I think at our thing, I mentioned the fact that, and what really drove me to jumping on the table at that meeting I was telling you about was, you know, two homeless folks had died and were murdered actually in the prior week, the week before. And the person who wasn't an indigenous leader in the city, said that, well, we have to have patience. And then I started speaking about, what are you talking about, patience? How can we have patience when people are getting murdered on the street as homeless people and people are dying on our streets every day? And then she spoke to me like I was 12 years old, and I couldn't stand it. And
I mean, that's where that comes in, where, you know, not being looked at, like, when you have lived experience, like, again, a different knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not being looked at in that light,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, you feel like you're not being heard.
Entirely. And every once in a while, you know, I get on social media and I'll say things that are, like, I'll kind of go overboard, because you don't get people's attention sometimes if you don't. And so, you know, so you have to sometimes stand up and make a statement. And so I do that every once, not often, but every once in a while, because, you know, I'll just read something that the government's done again or the city's done again, and I'll say, what are you guys thinking, you know? And, but, you know, we also, as we know, we also have to walk the line. But I'm in a peculiar position because I can go out and say things that, you know, Jamil or Frank cannot. You know, you know, everything's predicated on government funding, right?
Well, and that's how we operate to help people, right? And you know, and then you have, like, you know, you're your work person, then you're your personal, you're like your personalized person, right?
Yep.
And, you know, when I come into work, I am here for the relative.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, you know, if, like, for example, like, okay, so, like, we don't have enough rehabs in Winnipeg.
No.
We don't.
Of course not.
If I'm having to help people, okay, and they want to go, when an addict wants to get sober, they don't want to wait a month or 2 months or 3 months.
No.
You need to hit the nail when they're ready.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that because there's not.
No.
The epidemic is so big right now. Yeah, and I mean, like, that's, if you want to call it that, addiction is so big right now, but there's, you know, we have a lot of houseless folks.
We do. And, you know, I've been part of the homeless count every year since, every time, it's, you know, since 2015, and those numbers are growing. And the number we came up with this year was 2,200. I think that's over the number, maybe, but it's high because we had it over 4 days this year, and people want to come back and get their gifts, you know, for doing the interviews, you know. But still, the numbers are rising and not going down. And every once in a while, I'll go on LinkedIn or on Facebook, I say, take off those damn rose-colored glasses, and quit saying that we're going to end homelessness. You know, it's.
I think like a good direction they did go in is like the Your Way Home strategy. Okay,
yeah.
I 100% believe you. If you give people housing, that helps. But again, you need to wrap around support. Right?
You do, and you know the problem with that project is they don't have enough wraparound supports. They don't have enough personnel to do that. I talk to Tessa quite often, and you know, I'll say, okay, so how's that going now? and I'll hear one story from her, and I'll hear one story from somebody else who's in it. And it's so important to have wraparound supports. And you know, I was the first intensive case manager in the country with lived experience, going back to the At Home Safe SWA days, and you know, that housing first program with all the wraparound supports and stuff. And I cut my teeth on the housing first and wraparound supports, and I developed my own housing program in three cities because of my experiences there and with CMHA. And it's so hard to do it right. It's, you know,
everybody's different, right?
Everybody's different, yes. And when they say unique housing, that means something, right?
100%.
What's that?
100%.
100%, like yes, it does.
I work like as a support on one of the COA home project, and I see tremendous growth. That is awesome, but we, you know, the lived experience folks that we do have need to come out of the woodwork and come into the work too,
yes.
Because we just need more. There's not enough, right?
Yes, entirely.
There's not enough, and you know, some of them because of fear or whatever, right? A lot of them aren't there yet, and that's fine, but it's muchly needed right now because, like, we're in the middle of winter, not the middle of winter, but it's snowing.
Well, we're getting there in a hurry.
Yeah, and it's getting colder, and I honestly was... Going down somewhere the other day, and I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, hey, there's like no bus shack. What are people going to do?
And you know what? This is on the city. They took them down on purpose. You know?
Well, I seen a post, I guess it's Japan. They have these seats and they're heated. I'm like, wow, what if they should bring
that
in?
And guess what? The city took away the heated seats so people wouldn't go into bus shelters. And they did that about 5 years ago. And, you know, and since about 5 years ago, there's been no heated seats in bus shelters anymore. And they did that to keep the homeless folks, our brothers and sisters on the streets, out of the bus shelters, right? And that just shows the big old heart of our city. And I can sit in judgment of the city and the way they treat people who are homeless. And I say it's a city with no heart, because within those walls of City Hall, they're doing so many things that hurt the people on the street.
Like I said, the Your Way Home project, I feel is the right direction. But we have so many houseless people that, like, and we have so many vacant buildings.
Yes. And you know, but, you know, the Manitoba Housing lets so much housing go, into shambles or, you know, get dilapidated so they're unlivable. And that isn't that a shame? Because there would be so many open spaces now that, you know, so many, if they just not let them go. And
even just fixing them up, right? Because there has to be a better solution. And I mean, like I said, we're going towards that direction, but it's been like, I almost 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's changed so much since then in a positive way. In a positive way, right? So I'm hoping that, you know, they open up more buildings.
Oh, they really need to. And, you know, they wasted a good bit of space in Cap Young Barracks where there are hundreds and hundreds of units there. And, and we could have, it could have been used, the old military housing.
And what are they doing with that?
There were hundreds. They got torn down.
What are they doing with that space, though?
I think a First Nations organization. I think it might be PEGWES, but I'm not sure. Is somebody is going to be hopefully developing that, but okay. but they just let them go. And this could have been a lifesaver for so many people. And, you know, again, Manitoba Housing, you know, 185 Smith is a good example, where 300 units, and they let the building get into such disarray and it became uninhabitable. So another real estate organization came in, paid $60 million for it, spent another $20 in repairs, and now it's market value. But we lost rent geared to income housing there because the province did not have the vision to actually, or the wisdom to keep those open. So where did those 300 people go? They went into market housing. A lot of them went into market housing, right?
And I think that, you know, I didn't know about that, but I feel like even something like that, okay, if we have, we'll call it marginalized,
right? Yes.
Marginalized. And you're identifying that, and mm-hmm. this is a good step too. If you're able to identify, okay, this apartment block is very marginalized,
yes.
bring wraparound supports in there so it doesn't happen, right? Mm-hmm. Like prevent it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I've taken a lot of heat because, you know, I created this, you know, with private funding. I've created this, you know, housing program in Toronto and Vancouver that are huge, Winnipeg very small, but I call it Housing First on steroids. And it's, you know, we'll give them cooks for 6 weeks, and while the cooks are there making three meals a day, they'll also be teaching. And we'll give them housekeepers for 6 weeks until they learn that particular skill, right? And it's so important. You know, we have to do whatever we can to guarantee success for people that we put into housing, and whatever we can do, we teach them shopping skills, you know, and which is so important, especially today when everything's going through the roof. You don't go buying Nabob coffee when there's, you know, no-name coffee on sale, right? Nabob's my favorite, but I can't afford to drink it anymore. but it's, you know, we have to give wraparound supports to guarantee success. And with success in housing comes success in life, and people move forward in their lives. They when there are jobs, they'll, you know, they get put to work, and they become, once you deal with getting over the trauma is the biggest thing. And we have in-house trauma counselors, or, you know, we have trauma-informed counselors. Once people, you know, get over the trauma of the streets, then people can move forward. And what people, it took me 7 years to get over the trauma of the streets, seven, before I could get my voice back.
And I mean, some people, you know, often it's a different timeline for everybody, right?
It's a different timeline.
In that survival, sometimes it's like you're packing on stuff on a plate. It just keeps going, right?
Yeah.
And then when you have to unpack that plate, it is difficult.
It really is. And you're so right. You said the really important thing. Everybody's timeline is different.
Yeah.
And you can't cook. There's no cookie cutter solution to any of this stuff, and that's the problem, and that's part of what the government still realize. And I still see, you know, so much of the second class citizenship, and when I hear the mayor talk about the homeless, he talks about somebody that's almost subhuman, because we're going to do this. It's just, as a person who's been there, I really take it personally, because I hate hearing that kind of talk, you know, and not understanding what people are going through on the streets. But folks, we got to take a music break, and Chantel, hang on the line, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
Million and seven stars await for you.
watching while everything grows, and the field is for those not afraid to be free. I'm gonna take my time, and I'm gonna take my time. The days are numbered, and that's just fine.
And you're listening to the Hope Valley of No Fixed Address show. Right now, the temperature is minus 11, I think, still minus 10. Slight snow falling. And folks, buy an extra copy of that person that's going to be sitting right outside the Tim's that you're going into, right outside McDonald's, for example. Just buy an extra cup. And the music, by the way, was Madeline Roger, a local artist, and it's SoCan Week, so we do our best to play local talents. And on the show today, I have mind blank.
Chantel
From 190s Radio, or Nadine Way Back, which means our relatives. Or can you correct me on that?
A relative's place.
Yes. We're talking lived experience, and we're talking the homeless issues. And we were just at the End Homeless Winnipeg gathering that they have. This is their second one this year. And I was grateful to them to put together a lived experience panel there. And I raised a real fuss about my good friend who is in your building there, Christy Pearson, who runs Linking Hope upstairs, and being a non-lived experience person, being the moderator and asking the questions. And she's a great friend, but they have to raise that issue because, you know, we're the ones with the knowledge, so we should be asking those questions. So then Adams went big, sent us a list of questions, and I said, pardon me, if you're using these questions, and one of the questions was the proverbial adolescent question, what is home? Which has been, you know, way overused and overdone for many, many years. I said, if these are the questions, I'm going to have to recuse myself from this from the panel because we need to tell the story. We need to have some depth to the questions. And then Christy sent us a list of questions on the morning of, I was really, really impressed because they made me think, and nothing makes me think, generally speaking, because we're in this thing, right? We know. And she came with a question that was so good, and we had a room full of over 100 people, and you could hear a pin drop in that room. And I think we opened some people's eyes because there are still some people in this sector that just don't have a clue about, you know, don't know enough about lived experience. And, you know, it became so clear that some people, we were saying things that people had never heard before. And that just seemed really... you know, I respected the fact that everybody had bought in, right? And yeah. Everybody was buying in and listening, and their eyes were there, and you could see it on their faces. But it's so important that we, as people with lived experience, you know, we have a responsibility. Those of us like you and I who can articulate have the responsibility to do that. Or what are your thoughts on that?
I think that people with lived experience need to take up room.
What's that?
They need to take up room.
Yes, like, yes, that's a good term.
Yes, they need to take up room more. Mm-hmm. And because like I said, like I think that the results will be different.
Yes.
The results will be different.
They will.
I see it day in, day out. I do. And I do feel like if you're a lived experience going to something and you don't, you know, feel comfortable with questions, that you have every right to be like, no, I'm not answering these. Because, I mean, there's no connection to it, right?
No.
And though people try, right? Mm-hmm. They do. It comes from a lived experience perspective, you're kind of just like, well, I applaud you for trying, but yeah, I don't connect with this, right?
Yeah, entirely.
I'm going to be polite about it, right? But, like, deep in my mind, I'm like, okay. Okay, I'm going to be respectful and kind, but
yeah,
my personal thoughts are that this could have been done better.
And yeah, exactly. But you know what? And people don't realize it takes years to get to this point. Like even I would say 4 years ago, I may not have said anything. But you know, and I was almost 14 years ago, right? But it takes such a long time to get that confidence back. I was this arrogant SOB sales guy who knew everything, could do everything. You know.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm always curious, anybody that has lived experience.
Mm.
Okay, so your life before you became hopeless, what are the things that life taught you after you went through that? During it, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, the whole thing is I'm using those skills that I had back then. I'm using those today to sell policy change and all that kind of stuff. But it taught me that, you know, we are no better, no worse than everybody else. And it's so plain to see. Like today, we have to talk about that because people in the street are seen as second-class citizens.
And that's not fair.
What's that?
That's not fair, Ron.
No, it's not. No, it's not. No, it's not. And so I what I learned was, we have to have confidence to do and say the things we do. We absolutely have to, you know, and my confidence is probably more now than when I was a successful, you know, ad sales guy. But my values have changed, and I use those skills to change policies where I can and to uplift the folks on the street and uplift people with lived experience. But what the difference was, to me, it brought humility and that I never had before. And I was always a, you know, overconfident, you know, arrogant guy, right? That's who it was. And what it did, and that one of that the very same question that you're asking was kind of asked on that panel. And for me, I never had empathy before.
Fair enough.
And today, it burns inside me. And, you know, I have so much empathy. And why I have to speak out against the city, why I have to speak out against the problems, because I take those things that they say about people on the street, and I take like second-class citizenship very personally. And I think that the one thing I learned from the experience was empathy and caring for people so deeply and the fact that I now understand them. Whereas before, my great gift to the homeless was filling my Mercedes up with turkeys and taking them down to Saloma Christmas, right? You know, that was it.
No, I get it.
I made myself feel good because I did something good, right?
I think life, you know, has a funny way of humbling us.
Mm-hmm.
Before I went through everything I went through, I remember, you know, I had met somebody that was using a drug, and I said, oh, I'd never touch that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd never touch that, right? No, no, no.
Yeah, yeah.
And a year and a half later, I found myself sitting in the same spot, injecting a drug that I said I'd never try. That is when life humbles you.
Yes. It does. It changes. It changes you 360. And again, I understand getting rejected by the healthcare system. I was rejected time and time and time again by the healthcare system, needing to jump off a bridge, commit suicide while I was homeless because I couldn't get help that I needed. And what that did is, like, I'm on 14 committees and boards with the WHA. I train executives and leadership of hospitals and all that kind of thing because I have to. I've been given that opportunity because I have to. But it showed me, again, I walk into an emergency room now and say you're at some health sciences center, and you and I both know that 80% of the people in there will be indigenous, and they'll also be neglected.
Mm-hmm.
And I was neglected as well. But now I understand. You know, I did not have that understanding before. Now I feel for those people. I never did that before. I was a NIMBY before. I used to live in Wellington Crescent, for crying out loud, and I would, and I had people removed from the riverbank, right? You know,
and it's funny that life changes like that. You know, like mm-hmm. now you wouldn't do that, right?
No, of course not.
You went through that in life, and had you not gone, and this is where I'm like, you know, when I work with relatives and stuff, and I'm like. But, you know, you made it through that.
Yes.
You made it through that. There's a reason why.
Yeah, entirely. And I firmly believe that I've gone through all the things. I survived 3 near-death experiences, including the bridge jump, and I'm not a swimmer at all. And I should have died right there. And 2 others. And, you know, I know I survived those things. I know I'm here for a reason. I never used to buy into that crap, right? You know? Never,
but lived it, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't be on the air today and doing this stuff, right? You know,
and that's why life is so beautiful like that. And I mean, like, and I, you know, once you get to that point, you're like, okay, well, I transmuted this into this, right?
Yes, yep.
It was very beautiful.
Yes.
But like, you know, and then, you know, when you're like, people that are helpless and you're working with them, you're just like, hey, when are you going to get to that point? Okay, mm-hmm. I'm standing beside you holding your hand.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I'm doing. I'm mm-hmm. offering you love and kindness.
Yes,
fantastic.
Yes. And, you know, I do a lot of talks. I cussed my 200th talk for United Way last week. And one of the, you know, things I said, you know, my life has changed. You know, it's changed 360 degrees. I now have more confidence than I ever had before in my life, but it's used for different things, right? And, you know, I've come to the place where I'm accepting who I am, but we all go through that imposter syndrome thing so many times, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but you know, somebody's made it possible. I've become to believe in, you know, I'm an old preacher's kid, right? But I never believed until I went through all this that there is a higher power.
And like, I feel personally that going through all of that was my spiritual awakening.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
100% was. But I'm like, oh, because I didn't have the same beliefs they did then as I do now.
Exactly. And, you know, I grew up rebelling because I was a black sheep, and my dad and I never got along at all because he's a very dominant person, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I just rebelled against all that stuff.
I was about rebellion, too.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
You tell me I can't do something. Well, you know,
yeah,
I can do it.
Exactly. It. And that's why, you know, the lived experience and all the barriers that I've faced, going back in the day, I was kind of a pioneer for lived experience. And you know, first getting honorariums, there were no honorariums. Then there was $10 token gift cards, for crying out loud, right? And then we had to work on that and work on that until finally, you know, we're actually getting paid some money just to do to show up at meetings at times.
And I mean that's important. And here's the thing with that is, like, I feel like, you know, I came in a time where they were already giving those out.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, my knowledge of it is would be different than yours, but I do feel like, you know, if you're going somewhere and sharing that, that's trauma you went through. That is suffering you went through that all other things made money off it. And around, if you want to get deep about it, right?
You know what? I put it on my third annual human rights symposium in April. I would really like to make room for you on my lived experience panel. Or give you a podium, a spot on your own, because you have what I'm looking for.
interested.
But we'll keep in touch on that one, and yeah. You know, I actually think that our conversations will continue other than radio here,
okay.
And I love for that to happen. I seldom meet people who I can relate to on this level.
Okay.
You know, as a person with lived experience, so
it's refreshing.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
It truly is. And you know, I was impressed at our little forum that you were one of the ones that spoke out, and I you know I have an ear and eye, and for this kind of stuff.
And for me, I usually just a lot of those things I sit and observe.
Mm-hmm.
it's a thing I've learned to do.
Yeah,
being in survival, so mm-hmm. I sit and observe, and then if I have something to say, I'll speak on it. But I listen and observe, right? Because I just got to see where everybody's at, right?
Yes. And I do thank you for making the time today. I know you're busy with training and other stuff there. And by the way, say hello to my good buddy Frank there too. But do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to speak on, whether it's lived experience or in a way back? And I didn't want to get into the controversial subject of 72 hours, so we're parking it. And
Thank you. Of course.
Do you have any words that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Honestly, when I'm talking to you, all I think about is healing, purpose, and community. Mm-hmm. If you're going to take anything from that, think of those words,
yes.
And as the community should.
Absolutely.
And make lived experience need to take space.
Yes. We actually need to grab it. It's not going to be given to us in most times. So we just have to go in there and create our own space and use our elbows to get there. And that's I've learned to do that, but it's so hard. When you're always bucking a trend, right? But
eventually, it's going to work out.
It will. Yes. But thank you so much for your time, Chantel.
Thank you.
And we'll see you soon. I'll talk soon.
Have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye bye.
Okay, bye bye.
That was Chantel, the office manager of Ndinwe Mac, a person with lived experience who's come a long ways and actually is in a leadership role at the biggest shelter in Winnipeg. And I'm so thrilled to have her on today because, as you can tell, she articulates and she can speak to issues where sometimes people with lived experience just can't speak that way yet because of the trauma, what they've been through. And for me, it took 7 years. I would sit at boards and committees and not say a word. And because I didn't have the confidence yet, now they all wish I'd shut up and go away, which is a good thing, I guess. But folks, come back next week. I don't know who our guest is going to be yet, but I will be here next week. There's nothing on the calendar that's standing in my way. And so we'll continue our chat and hopefully can find somebody very interesting for you to chat. If nothing else, Debbie and I can always talk about something. We can talk about symposium a little bit too, because it's looking really, really good right now. And I have a new MC for the afternoon that's going to be really outstanding. And it's one of the loose ends I had to tie up, but everything's going well. But folks, come back next week. I have more stories for you. Take care.
used to a girl, I haven't got a clue. Somebody fill me in where a man got to. Help me with my microphone. Help me lift this curse. Help me wrap my head around this verse. You don't have to say what you already showed. I was worthless. I was worthless. I was worthless since 16 weeks old. I'm just a girl who made a little mess. How to fix me up is anybody's guess. Bleeding in the kitchen, catch up on the child. Talking too much, acting too wild. You don't have to tell me what I already know. I was paid less, I was paid less, I was paid less since 16 years old. I'm a thinker, I'm a hiker, I'm a mountain biker. I'm a shovel, I'm a hammer, I'm a creaky ladder. I'm a hugger, I'm a mother, I'm a midnight lover, and I'm a dancer, I'm a singer, I'm a long hair tosser. I love to love you loving me. I have a woman's body, and it mostly does the trick for me, except for when I'm told what I'm not meant to be. Don't make me hear it. short hair turned to gray. My photos faded in your hand.
Your friends on the radio, CKUW 95.9 FM.
CKUW, you're listening to the one and only CKUW 95.9 FM.
I'm composer Michael Conway Baker, and you are tuned to CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
Tune in, get what's happening. You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM.
CKUW 95.9 FM, Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada.